welcome to Holden Village in the Fireside Room. Today's speaker is Mark Schwain, and he will be speaking on Everyone a Teacher. So let's listen in on Mark.
My name is Mark Schwain, and the title of this session is Everyone a Teacher. And I'd like to welcome you all, and especially those who just came up to the village today. This really is the second of a two-part series of sessions, but you don't have to worry if you weren't here at the first session. I'm going to say just a little bit about what we did then to supply a kind of context for this title, Everyone a Teacher. And then I'll say a little bit about the subject, and then engage all of you in, I hope, some reflections about the subject at hand. So let me just say a few things about what we talked about yesterday. The title of the session was Education Under Siege. And some of us who are here again this time spent an hour puzzling out why it seems, at least over the course of the last year or so, as though all of the institutions of education, elementary schools, secondary schools, colleges, and universities, seem so besieged by public criticism and by all kinds of other things internal to those institutions. And we suggested, I tried to offer a framework for folks who came to the session to think about any story that they encountered in the news having to do with education, whether it's a story about declining SAT averages or a story about how costs of education are escalating more rapidly than cost of living standards, or whether one's talking about multiculturalism on the campuses, et cetera. And as part of that framework for inviting people to think about and therefore be able to interpret a whole range of news stories about education, the first thing that we thought about was that there has to instantly be a distinction between, on the one hand, education, and on the other hand, schooling. All schooling may be education, but not all education is schooling. And I suggested that one of the reasons that education defined as schooling has come under such severe public scrutiny over the course of the last decade, one reason, is that a lot of the other institutions, the family, churches, neighborhoods, voluntary associations like PTAs, like YMCAs, and so on, that have customarily assumed the burdens of educating one generation to prepare it to assume adult responsibilities in the next, are themselves sort of under siege. That is, families are deteriorating, we read. Neighborhoods are coming apart, we read. A number of voluntary associations like YMCAs that have customarily engaged in the education of young people are waning in terms of both the number of such associations and the number of people who volunteer their time and energies to serve within them. And so as this whole network of institutions begins to unravel, the elementary schools and secondary schools and colleges and universities are expected to do more and more and more and more and more in order to make up for what some of these other institutions are no longer doing. In other words, once you see that education, and I defined it very broadly as the whole process by which any civilization, including our own, transmits the knowledge and the skills and the fund of wisdom and the arts that are necessary to continue to sustain a decent human life from one generation to another. If you take education broadly defined that way, and you see that schooling is just then a tiny part of that, that gives you a different take on why some of our institutions of higher learning are under such close scrutiny and hung in the balances and find wanting. Namely, they're being expected to perform more and more and more of the functions that were once reserved for families or neighborhoods or other institutions, churches, for example. And I used as a key case of this the whole debate over sex education, which would have been thought incomprehensible to people in the 19th century, that suddenly you would look to schools as the institutions that were responsible for sex education. That would have just been thought not something that schools were expected to perform. One would have assumed that families, churches, neighborhoods, relatives, etc., would have taken care of that. And so the fact that it's such a hot issue in schools and such a hot issue of public debate suggests that other institutions that were historically charged with that responsibility are no longer performing it, or no longer performing it as well as the public thinks that they should. And I talked a little bit about how historians of education interpret the rise of schools as related to other institutions changing and turning over some of the tasks that extended families performed as extended families became nuclear families to these weird institutions called schools. So that was the kind of relevant part of the context in which now we're talking about the subject, everyone a teacher. As we reviewed all of the sources of criticism and difficulties with schools, we decided at the end of the session that one could take two responses to the whole problem of schooling. One was to undertake certain collective measures, politically and socially, to improve the quality of education, demanding that governments and other sources of revenue not be quite so stingy with funds as they are nowadays, being more vigilant in joining PTAs and other organizations that are concerned with these matters. But another tack citizens might take, and we come now to tonight's topic, is to simply recognize and lift up to the public just how much of everyone's life is in some way or another involved with education, defined broadly now as the transmission of those arts, skills, wisdom, and knowledge from one generation to another. So this includes everything from teaching a youngster how to brush his or her teeth, to teaching a youngster how to fly fish or how to tie their shoes, to teaching here in the village, to take just local examples, all of the people involved in arts and crafts, to tell you how to throw pots, and to sit there and teach you how to run one of the weaving machines and so forth. All of these myriad activities involve teaching. So another whole approach citizens might take to their despair over what they take to be a kind of decline in the schools in our society, in the quality of the schools, if that's true, is to simply recognize how much of their own activities every day are bound up with teaching, and to wonder together, having seen that, how they might become better at it than they are. In other words, how can all of us, given that we are all teachers, and I don't think too many of us would want to dispute that, we all are teachers, how can we get better at it? What makes for good teaching? But this time asking the question is not asking the question what makes good classroom teaching, but just plain what makes good teaching period, whether in the classroom or outside of it. Because just as education shouldn't be confused with schooling, okay, teaching shouldn't be confused with classroom activity. Classroom activity is one arena in which teaching goes on, but it's only one of an infinite myriad of arenas in which teaching goes on. Am I being clear so far about the whole urgency and relevance of this question? Okay, so what I'd like to do is to explore, basically, in the rest of the time we have together, what makes good teaching for all of us. And I'd like to begin with the following exercise. I'm going to look at my watch, and I'm going to give everyone 2 minutes. And I want you in those 2 minutes to reflect silently to yourselves on this question. Who were or who are the three best teachers that you have had up to this point of your lives? And remember, I'm not confining this to classroom teachers. Grandfathers, grandmothers, fathers, mothers, older brothers, older sisters, all of those are fair game. So I'm going to start in 10 seconds and give you 2 minutes to think and call up to your mind who are the three best teachers you've had, beginning now. Okay, for those of you who just joined us, I should explain we weren't in a seance here. we were thinking together quietly about who in our lives thus far had been the three best teachers that we'd had. And by teachers, we did not mean just those in classrooms, though people in classrooms are perfectly eligible for candidacy here, could be grandfathers, grandmothers, parents, whatever. And I just asked people to spend 2 minutes to think of those three. Now I want you to take 45 seconds to ask yourself a tougher question and at least begin to form an answer to it and be ready to share with the group what your answer is. What I want you to try to puzzle out now in 45 seconds is, now that you have the three people, what, if anything, did those three people have in common that made them such good teachers? So 45 seconds will begin now. Okay. Now it's your turn to speak. Does anybody want to volunteer what they just learned as they looked within themselves and their memories as to what their three best teachers had in common, if anything? And it's perfectly all right to say, gee, I couldn't see that they had anything in common. Yes?
The people I have in mind were very passionate about what they taught, and they really loved what they were teaching, and that really touched me and opened me up to what they had to teach.
Okay. So it was a passionate love for the subject, whether it was a craft or a subject matter, whatever. Yes.
For me, it wasn't even a thought that it was so obvious. They cared about me.
Okay. So for you, it was also a sense that you felt a kind of love in them, but the love was for you not more than it was, but that's what impressed you rather than love for the subject,
right,
or the craft or the art or the skill. Yes.
They were patient.
Yes.
They were patient. They had a lot of self-control when working to help me be who I am.
Okay, so the virtue of patience. So we've got love of subject, love of students, and the virtue of patience. Great. Yes, Dorothy?
I would. This might be similar to patience, but said a different way. They forgave me many times over in the midst of teaching.
Great. Yes, Bill?
People of integrity.
So they had a kind of character, the three of them. And can you draw out a little bit what you mean by integrity?
There was just an honesty, a conscientiousness, they were whole people.
Mm-hmm. You didn't feel like somehow they were having unmet needs and issues of their own that they were using you to meet and so on, so that they were healthy human beings who were possessed of integrity. Yes.
They were able to use language and examples that I could understand.
Okay. So that they were very skilled at communicating with you and being able to find just the right story, example, illustration, so that you caught on to what was at issue. Yes, Celeste?
I think that the really fine teachers that I've had, this is similar to what you just said now, were able to meet me not at my level, but only slightly beyond, so that you feel like you can get there someday. You know, sometimes if they're too brilliant, they're too far away, you know it, it just seems hopeless. Mm-hmm. But good teachers are able to kind of scale down to where you might actually achieve.
Okay. Yes?
I had a confession of, I think you have one teacher in particular. She didn't like come across as like she knew all the answers. I mean, she wasn't. She set up classes so that discussion was an important part, and also she brought in people from the community that had experience. You know, she often talked about the different levels of learning. There's you know, first. I'm sorry. there's the, well, like when you're, you know, in a classroom situation, you're kind of very removed. You know, actual experiential knowledge. So she would bring people in from the community that had experience in certain things like social work and so on and so forth. And which, you know, is even more important.
So you're thinking of a classroom teacher, and what you first said was that, was it a she, did you say? She didn't, she wasn't pretentious and didn't seem as though she had all the answers, but seemed to be in there with you trying to work at getting closer to the truth of matters or into deeper understanding of what was at issue. So a kind of a virtue of humility or something of that sort. Yes?
Time. They gave of their time.
Generosity. So that they went the second mile. It wasn't as though they confined themselves to just what was minimally required. Extended themselves beyond. Yes, back there.
Kind of a combination of a couple things that have already been said, that on the one hand they were good examples of a particular skill or value, something, a model for me, but at the same time they paid enough and the right kind of attention to me that I felt that it was within me to get to where they were at, whether it's in skill or the way that, you know, yeah.
Good. So you're talking about, you introduced something of a new idea here, which is the idea of being able to embody an example, not just offer some, but they somehow themselves embodied a certain ideal so that by imitating who they were, you learned a great deal. Yes, ma'am.
Well, to give their time and their energy and their experiences to give you the knowledge that they had, then you could go ahead and try to learn from their experiences too, or their craft, or whatever you want to call it, that they've already done it, and they would like for you to learn and to go on from there. Their time, their compassion, their love, their understanding to teach you to go on.
Okay, great. Yes, Julie.
It's real similar to that, and something about knowing that they care for me is I had this one mentor who had, she just kept telling me to trust my gut, you know? She just really saw something in myself that I couldn't hold on to, that she like believed me into who I could be. It was an amazing experience.
Good. So basically, she saw things and potentials and truths within you that you didn't even know were there and helped draw them out of you.
And I didn't trust them. She kept telling me to trust it.
Mm-hmm. Great.
In
yes, Mark.
American Indian background, the elders are the ones that we respect. But in our tradition and the elders that I have listened to, they not only speak with authority, but they speak at a level that we as Indian people that listen to our other Indian people, we understand that we benefit through that.
Being able to take their wisdom and present it in such a way so that it's accessible.
That we're knowledgeable of.
Okay.
And they speak with authority.
Okay. Good. Yes, way back there.
One thing, like, the three that I try to think of are quite a bit different in a lot of ways, but one thing that was common was that they were all really good listeners, as well as, like, to be able to pay attention to you and to listen to things and sort of grow on that and mm-hmm. then expand on things that you tell them.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to clear things up and in some ways make things clearer for you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
One more.
The
good teacher that I've had always treated me with respect.
Okay. Okay. Two more. two more voices. Yours and then Jan.
A good sense of humor and laughing together.
Oh, okay.
A lot of value.
And all three of your mentors that you thought of had that in common.
Lifestyles that I really admired too, that I got to know the person more than just eating.
Good, thank you. Jan?
Well, when I thought about teachers, the three that I picked were my mother, father, early family, my husband, and my children.
Can't hear you.
Yeah, and I think the three that I had picked was my parents, early childhood, and my husband, mainly my faith life, and then our children. And I thought they all have in common an unconditional commitment. In other words, the forgiving comes in, the love comes in, everything. And I think that they were the most important influences. Though I had good teachers and classrooms all my life, the ones that influenced me the most were my best teachers who influenced me.
Okay. Well, that's very a wonderful collection of statements and conclusions. Now, what's very interesting about these taken together is that they cut almost totally against the grain of most of what you would read in the standard educational literature on teaching. That is to say, what all of you cited were qualities of character and virtues, integrity, generosity, patience, love, forgiveness, attentiveness. We could, you know, fill out the whole list. I should have taken better notes, but I think I hit. A couple of you mentioned the personal examples that they set for you, and. So it was really qualities of character, to some extent qualities of mind, because there was some emphasis on their capacity to discern through their attention just exactly where you were and the kind of word you needed to hear, or to discern, as Julie said, what was there in your soul that needed to be drawn out and affirmed so that you could learn to trust yourself more deeply. So that they were good, they had intellectual virtues. It's not as though they lacked those. But you're all mentioning qualities of character as what really made your three teachers great teachers. And much of the educational literature reviews teaching as the technical word for it would be techne. That is, if you just get the right set of techniques and people give you a set of guidelines or rules of thumb, that if you just somehow follow these, then you will be a better teacher. Whereas all of you, with one or two exceptions, there were a few anecdotes about techniques that a favorite teacher used that really helped you. You mentioned experiential learning and bringing people in from the community and so on. But I think even your account of what made your teacher a good teacher was really more toward her character and less toward a set of techniques that she had. So that what's interesting as we sort of reflect on our own experiences, pick our best teachers, ask what they had in common, is that these go much more to the character of the teacher, to his or her virtues, than to his or her techniques. Indeed, I don't know if this is true, but I suspect it's true, and I'll invite you to correct me if it's not. My guess would be that if you now looked back at your three and tried to figure out whether they all had the same techniques, my guess is they probably didn't. I mean, in other words, that what they had in common were virtues, not techniques. My own three, just to tell you, were wildly different in terms of techniques, but very similar in terms of virtues. I mean, one of them happened to lecture all the time, and I was just astounded by the way in which his lectures seemed to take account of where his audience was all the time and bring them along into the excitement and into his passion, to pick up on your very first point, the kind of passion conveyed. Others were very much more skillful at the knack of engaging me, learning along with me, as some of you put it, et cetera. So the techniques that they used were totally different. They had no similar techniques, but they did have certain virtues in common, not unlike the ones you mentioned, humility, patience, attentiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a very interesting thing to reflect on, that when we reflect on our own experience, that's what we come up with. Let me give you just a few moments to review in your own mind. Did any of your teachers have the three that you picked, common techniques, modes of teaching you? Or did they have a wide repertoire? Phil?
All different.
Yours were all different. I see lots of heads nodding. So it's true that if we had just looked at techniques, everybody would have been very different. That's not what they had in common. Okay, now let me go to draw out from what you said another subject that, bless your hearts, came up immediately in the first three or four comments. One of the things that has happened over the past 5 years as I've been reading more deeply into questions of what makes good teaching, and admittedly, most of these readings have been taken up with the narrower sense of classroom teaching rather than a broader sense of teaching we're talking about, have said one of three things about what makes for good teaching. And these all came up here. But there's a lot of argument over which of the three makes the most sense. One has said, look, teaching is finally student-centered. The love the teacher has to have most is what a couple of you brought up, love for the students. So in some ways, teaching has to be student-centered. What's crucial in good teaching is not only love for the students, but a specific attention to where they are, what they need, and what they long to know. So there's a whole body of reflection that suggests that. And some of you said that. There's another body that's much more oriented to what was said at the very first. You said it. It was a passion a love for the subject. Here the notion is that the good teacher, most of all, must love the art or the skill or the discipline or the subject that he or she is teaching. And that the good teacher conveys that passion to the student and in fact draws the student out of him or herself. Doesn't simply find out what it is that the student thinks he or she wants, but engages the student and draws them into a love for the subject. So there's another whole school out there that says the good teacher is subject-centered, not student-centered. Okay? Do you hear the difference in those two modes? And they've both come up here. Then there's a third school, which I think doesn't have very much credibility anymore, and the other two schools have attacked, which basically says that finally education is teacher-centered. Basically people have held that up to what's wrong with teaching, that insofar as a teacher thinks that education is teacher-centered, that the whole process is one for him or her to display their learning or display their wisdom or display themselves, that's where education begins to go wrong. But I want to read you a quote about a fourth alternative that focuses neither on the student, nor on the subject, nor on the teacher. And this quote comes from a recent article that was written by somebody who's a favorite here at the Village, Parker Palmer. And he's written this in a recent number of the National Teaching and Learning Forum. Here's what he says about good teaching. And notice how this provides another alternative. Good teaching is, above all, a connective activity. To teach is to weave a community of relationships between my students, my subject, and myself, to the end that students will develop their own capacity for connectedness. Where do these connections get made? Not primarily in assignments or tests or discussions, but inside of me. I must carry the connections within myself through each hour, from one day to the next, from one exercise to the next, and if I lose the thread, no one else will pick it up until students start to make connections on their own. And then they will participate in the weaving on their own. What I call weaving connections, some may call showing students how and why to learn a subject. But that sounds more cerebral, more heady, than the way I experience it. For me, he says, the connections that make for good teaching start in the teacher's heart, using heart not merely as the seat of emotion, but in its ancient meaning as the place where intellect, will, feeling, and purpose converge in the human self. The heart is the loom to which all of the threads must be tied and on which they must be woven. So it's no wonder that teaching tugs at and can break one's heart. Okay? So, take 30 seconds, go back to your three favorite teachers and ask yourselves, revisit them. Did they seem to be student-centered teachers? Did they seem to be subject-centered teachers? I presume none of them were teacher-centered teachers. Or would they have been more resonant to what Parker Palmer has written, the notion of weaving connections among themselves, the subject or the art or the skill, and you. So take 30 seconds and ponder that one. Good. You also introduce another element into this, which it hadn't occurred.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, but
that was very important.
You introduced another element though in this, which I hadn't thought to ask people, and I'm interested in taking a little detour now and doing it. You mentioned Jesus as a teacher, and this introduces the notion of someone who's not sort of visibly and immediately present, but mediately present through the texts and other things which make Jesus present to our lives. How many of you thought, when you thought of your three favorite teachers, of a being, whether it's Jesus or Socrates or Plato or Tolstoy or whatever, who is a character in a book or a historical figure? Okay, a lot of you did. Great. Do anybody else want to share some figures they thought of that were either fictional or real historical characters? Want to volunteer the names or not? Just keep them to yourself.
Mine was Jesus also, because I think that he does exactly what Parker Palmer was talking about, is this integration of practicing the virtues that he also embodies.
Oh, okay. Okay. And therefore has that kind of integrity Phil talked about.
I think the Native American stories and our legends are ones that have passed down through many generations. And one of the things that have, within our teachings in the American Indian tradition, is that we don't know where many of our legends have begun. And have gone down through our generation. And we just say, this is what we have heard, and this is what my father had told me, and this is what I'm telling you. And one of the things in our legends and our stories that are told in our Native American tradition is something like your parables that your Bible has, or has like a non-ending of the legend, so the listener of our legend, we make our own conclusions to be able to think on our own, similar to what Jesus Christ is.
So basically, you would say, in a way, that your stories are your best teachers, a certain fund of stories.
As a learning tool.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I was thinking of Dorothy Day, whose writings and lifestyle, she's really a mentor for me in how to live out gospel values.
I see. Okay, and so she was one of the three you had in mind. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let's hear from some others on the original question before we took the detour.
Well, yeah. my three are all entirely different. My father is a weaver. He cared about all of life and put all the pieces together. One was an academic whose passion for his subject is, but yet was able to convey that in a way that excited me and kept me engaged and I could learn. And the other was a manager in industry who had both a care for work, loyalty to a company, and care for people. And he was sort of subject, sort of people, and sort of weaver, but I don't think of him integrating all of life the way
your father did.
Yeah, it was much more limited in that way. I wouldn't describe him as a weaver.
Uh-huh.
So they were all different. They were just very different.
Okay. Other testimonies about your three and which of the models they fit, weaver, subject-centered, student-centered.
I think that one of my choices was one of my professors. And in a certain sense, he's very student-centered. But I think his way of expressing that is to teach the student everything he thinks is important, which is mostly subject. But it's... I definitely think it is student-centered, though, because it never... his interest in the subject doesn't ever overtake his teaching to the point that what he's saying has nothing to do with the students. It's very selective. But I think that that's a really powerful combination.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that he is himself then captured by the image of the weaver or not?
No. No, it's very very specific. The subject that he's interested in is very specific, but he teaches it to the students kind of as the most important life skill they will ever learn. They might not agree, but it's an effective way to teach.
Yeah, I think it's that kind of passion that some others have described, that when you're engaged with that person and pick up this passion they have for their subject, it is as though that particular subject is the most important thing you need to lead a decent human life, whatever it is, fly fishing or American Lutheranism, or implausible as that may seem.
I think one of the reasons is why is because I really experienced a lot of woundedness from our denomination for a variety of reasons, and it was in going back to seminary and not wanting to take that class, but all of the passion for his class, but also he really created space for me to heal my own stuff, and so there was a lot of healing that happened within the space of his classroom for me. So, and it's the oddest thing, American Lutheranism. It's almost embarrassing to talk about.
That's a very good point. There's finally a mystery about this that makes us laugh a bit when we come up with examples and fumble to try to put into words just how this can be. How this miracle can take place, that a subject like this, which we ourselves kind of laugh at as being so life-saving, nonetheless, in that context, the way he created a space, you put it as a healing space, really was just vitally and centrally important. Yes, ma'am?
When you stop and think about growing up in a church situation, to me that was a great teacher in itself, because you're learning to get along with people. You're being taught and explained and everything by a lot of different people. You're going to Bible classes. You're going to Bible camps. You're going to church organizations, your Bible studies. You're learning from everybody that's there. So I would say a good teacher is the church in
okay.
itself, besides your parents, besides your mentors.
Good. Thank you. I think that that's, I forget who said it first. Maybe it was Dorothy who said this first, but someone about Holden Village said, Holden Village is not a place where you get an education. It is itself an education.
Right.
And in other words, living in the village is an education. It isn't that you have these sessions like this one and you come and learn from them. I mean, you may learn something from this, but it's the whole experience of living in Holden Village, which embraces everything, that is what forms you more than it is an encounter with one person or another person, etc. And ranging from dish team to Vespers to encountering three garbage cans wherever you go, you know? I mean, I've had people say to me, which I think is great, that when they get out of Holden Village and they roll down the window and are ready to toss it out, the candy wrapper, they suddenly don't. They've been given new habits here. Their consciousness has been raised, to use another locution, and somehow when they've worked through garbology, if they've had that good fortune to actually get down in the nitty-gritty and find out what people throw away every day and just exactly what this means, they find themselves transformed. I mean, they've got different characters. It's not that they know a bunch of new stuff, it's that they leave different. So that's very, very nice. Thank you for the notion that the best teacher may be a particular community.
Why don't you just leave the idea, you actually take it home with you, you actually do your own garbology, you change your lifestyle. So
exactly.
You take home Holden with you.
Mm-hmm. Good.
sort of go back with one of the things you said at first or commented on. As families and neighborhoods and institutions and societies and extended families fall apart, there are fewer and fewer people who in fact partake of a kind of a culture which integrates and makes connections for you, except perhaps what we are fed through the newspapers, media, TV, that in fact we pay attention to more than what we used to in our terms of our life references.
And so is that to observe that we're in need or thirsty for the kind of communities that Holden represents because of this character of our lives?
Yeah, I think it would come from that, that people are in need of
integrative
experiences in their lives, which the mean streets, to put it that way, don't offer, except in a very restrictive fashion, which doesn't manifest life in wholeness.
Very nice. Very nice.
I kind of want to offer one kind of a thought I had about learning. I'm a parent of three girls, and I kind of see myself as more of a resource person again. I kind of believe in this sort of child-initiated learning, where you really have a lot of trust in the person, and you really believe that they kind of need, they kind of know what they need to know. And so the way I sort of facilitate that is by really listening to them, and then if there's something that they want to know or learn, then really jumping with that and then showing them where they can learn what they need to know. So it really involves having a lot of trust in them. And so I see myself as kind of a resource person if I have children.
We've talked about how you also like rituals in your home, things like this. So there's a web there. There's a wovenness, it seems to me, beyond what they themselves, because I'll try this out, what they think they need to know, that they're given a context which causes certain questions to come up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they...
And a lot of exposure to a lot of people and a lot of exposure in the world.
Right. Right. So would you say it's student-centered then, or more
person-initiated learning? So it's not like I'm offering them something per se, but I'm journeying with them.
Uh-huh. But you've set the table.
So to speak. I mean, yes, exposing them to a lot of people, a lot of experiences, but they get other ideas from other people, like in the neighborhood or in the world at the library. They just peruse through a lot of books. So yes and no.
Did you?
Yeah, I have to thought of another thing about Holden as a teacher. So many of the teachers that I have at Holden, and I'm thinking, have been people who have left me with more questions than answers. And to me, that's a really wonderful thing for a teacher to do. So that I am stopped. You know, I mean, I'm thirsty for more.
Okay, thank you. That adds another dimension, I think, to good teaching, that it creates in you a kind of hunger for more knowledge rather than this notion that your hunger can be satiated, that somehow the more you're filled, the deeper your longing, etc. Yes?
We have sort of made an assumption that we can, by observation, determine what good teaching is or by recollection, but it really is a mystery. I mean, it is such a mystery. And what learning is such a mystery. I don't know how many people saw that public TV program on acquisition of language, but it's just so amazing. A child at the age where they're acquiring language, if they hear a word correctly used in context once, can pop up using the word correctly in context, you know, a year or a long time later. The miracle of how we're put together and learn and what it takes to learn is just so incredibly wonderful. So.
And when you were talking about styles and so forth, I thought all of those, a good teacher will be switching and doing all of those in and out.
Mm-hmm. Resourcefulness.
Yeah.
But not only resourcefulness, but the experience and practical wisdom to know what resource to use at what time with what student, which can't be reduced to techne.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an art. I mean, how do you teach somebody when to apply rules? Well, you don't have rules to tell you when to apply rules, which is why techne never, which why techne never works as a kind of recipe for good teaching. Because even when you get the rules of thumb, and I want to be clear that some, I have used some books with great profit as a teacher that are sort of how-to books. You know, how to lead a good discussion. It's not all techne books are bad. But the point is that they by themselves, absent certain wisdom, experience, the art of teaching, the virtues, which is where you began, are going to do you no good, because then you'll not know when to apply the techniques in what contexts and so on. And I think finally, and I think I'll close with an anecdote of my own that picks up on your last point, because we're fast approaching 7:15. Part of my work involves a convening of a conversation for young, very gifted scholars who've just gotten PhDs and who want to teach in church-related institutions of higher learning, like those many of you attended. And one of the things that we read at the end of last semester was an early dialogue that was written by St. Augustine called On the Teacher. And it's interestingly enough, Augustine starts with the problem of language. And what's the relationship between words and things? And isn't it mysterious how people can learn this? And how is it that there's a connection between teaching and learning? All of the efforts to explain this, to come up with a kind of rational account for the connection between what I say and what you learn, just flounder. And Augustine is finally driven back to a kind of mystical language about the human soul, and talks about Christ and the truth within, and that being drawn out, and so on. But his vocabulary clearly, and he recognizes this, is bumping up against awesome mysteries and against processes which are deeply spiritual, and that we fumble to name and analyze. Not that we shouldn't analyze. I mean, his document is itself a dialogue that seeks to, through conversation, get at the truth. But it finally winds up with deeper questions, deeper longings, and a certain kind of awe at the whole process by which the child, when the mother holds up a can of peas in the kitchen and says, with the label, peas, a vital act of teaching, finally how that child comprehends that bizarre gesture pointing to that thing and makes all those connections is something that no amount of cognitive psychology is ever going to explain fully. And so we finally wind up, I think, when we reflect upon our experience, with a sense of awe and mystery and reverence and appreciation for how everyone's a teacher, and therefore everyone is engaged with very profound spiritual transactions, finally, and need good communities to nourish and sustain those practices.